Welch Narrow Chat back in your ears on this Saturday afternoon. I'm Jeremy Barron. I'm joined by Robbie Dunn. And Robbie, we're going to be talking about a, dare I say it, a comfortable win for Atletico over Barcelona tonight.
Yeah, it really was. The second half was pretty much not really a contest. Barcelona didn't, aside from that Coutinho shot, they didn't really look like scoring at all. And Atletico had a number of chances on the counter to maybe inflict even a worse defeat on them. But yeah, comfortable, I would say.
Yeah, this could have been maybe even 3 or 4 nil based on how Atletico were rolling along in that first half. And the second half was really a non-game. I mean, Barcelona ended up with over 70% possession, but I think just a one shot on target.
Yeah, and I think I don't really know that this... I'm not entirely sure that this does much to kind of kill the talk about Atletico's issues in attack, because all it does is confirm what we already know. Diego Simeone will punish you if you try to play possession against him, and he knows how to hurt teams on the counter. He knows how to... his teams can suffer, and they will kill you on the counter. And so I don't really think it does much to kind of fix... if Atletico were playing Barcelona every week, it'd be amazing. But they're not. So, they're going to have to find a way to break down more solid defenses. But for tonight, and to beat... Barcelona after winning in Milan in the midweek, I think it's a pretty successful week all around for Atletico.
Yeah, a pretty important game psychologically too, because for years Barcelona would torture Atletico. For years Atletico would try to enact the same strategy and get so close, but then Messi would score, or Suarez would score, or Ousmane Dembélé would score in the 90th minute. But there was none of that on Saturday at the Wanda Metropolitano, a nearly sold-out Wanda Metropolitano, over 60,000 in attendance as attendance restrictions lifted around Spain, although in Catalonia and in the Basque Country, they're going to remain in place for the time being. In the first half, Tomalema got it started, Robbie, in the 23rd minute on the counterattack. How did he get in there all alone? Why was there this much space available for him on the counter?
This is a problem with Barcelona's years ago. Like, they used to, like, obviously under Pep Guardiola, they had the 7 seconds or less, or I don't know if that was actually Guardiola who said that, but it was that kind of style where they got set in their build up, and they defended with the ball. So even if you won it back, they were in a position whereby they were rock solid at the back. Whereas now under Koeman, and without the threat of Messi destroying you, they aren't set, and they weren't set, and a number of times this evening they looked vulnerable at the back after losing possession and on the counter. And just, I mean, we see teams against the likes of Cadiz and these good counter-attacking teams, and they're open, and there's no real way to eliminate the risk of playing that possession-based style when you do get caught on the counter. But the best coaches I've seen, they're kind of... when they lose the ball, they're just wide open. And the problem with that possession this style is that it actually looks amateur when you do get caught like that, because there's like, for the second goal, and I know we're talking about the first right now, but for the second goal, it was a 2-on-1 with a half a pitch in front of Lamar and Suarez, like training ground stuff, you know. And I think Ronald Koeman can't just play defensively because Barcelona wouldn't allow it, but at the same time you have to do a better job of being ready when the breakdown does come.
And Atletico were ready to pounce, as you said. The best coaches know how to exploit this, And, you know, time and time again, we've seen Atletico try to do this in the past, but now with the state of Barca's squad, with some of their key players aging and some less experienced players in the team, Atleti were able to exploit it rather ruthlessly with the two counterattacking goals in the first half. That finish from Lemar was just brilliant, from the Suarez assist. We've talked about it a few times in the last couple weeks, but he's sensational now, Robbie. He's just absolutely essential.
Yeah, and I think that this is what we knew. Like, I mean, and Simeone has known, and it's why Simeone has stuck with him for so long. He's so dynamic and he's so agile, and that's the only two words I can use to describe him. He's just so agile and dynamic, and Simeone has said that himself in the past. And I think his goal was so well taken. The way he waited and waited and waited, and I was like, oh, it's gone, he's going to miss it. But absolutely buried in the top corner.
Yeah.
And brilliant. Yeah, it was a wonderful goal, but essential, yeah. And I think it was on this pod we spoke about it, but I mean, a credit to him for sticking with it, because his career looked almost dead and gone at Atletico. It was like, look, it was almost time to just cut your losses and move on. But he stuck in there, and he's just incredible.
Yeah, he's developing into a brilliant midfielder, and as you said, so dynamic, relentless in pushing the ball forward, and his aggression has just been so key to the transformation of Atletico's midfield, and so effective in facilitating that move away from the 4-4-2 to the modified 3-5-2 last year, just continuing this season. A few minutes later, Suarez had a wonderful chance that he just put wide, but we knew he wasn't going to miss that again if he got a second chance, and he did just before halftime. Lemar and Joao Felix combining again, and as you said, Robbie, there is just it's training ground stuff. Look at how much space there is on this goal that Barca are allowing defensively, and Gerard Pique is caught in the middle of Lemar and Suarez. Lemar tees up El Pistoletto. He takes his sweet time. One touch, two touch, three touch, and in it goes. That was almost insulting how much time he took.
when you look at that first chance, and I had said it last week, I was like, unless it's a one-touch chance for Suarez, forget about it, because he just doesn't have the kind of pay, or his build-up and his first touch had deserted him. But after missing the first one, I think the second one, and this is where his experience comes into play, and I have been critical of Suarez this season, but I think for the second chance, it looked like he was going to hit it really quickly, and then he realized, he was like, well, wait a minute, I've got loads of time here. He waited, and just rolled it in at the end. Like, it was an excellent finish, and one that a player like, say, I don't know who, but a more inexperienced player probably does hit that quicker, thinking he has less time. But Suarez realized that Barcelona weren't anywhere near him, and he had kind of calibrated his surroundings after the first miss, and he realized with the second one that, no, wait a minute, I've got time here, and just put it to bed completely with that one from, Barcelona. Yeah, that's the other thing, like, people were saying Barcelona are playing well, but they never really threatened either first half, I thought.
They did. I mean, the Coutinho had that chance almost immediately after Lemar scored. He just, it was a real rasping shot that just missed the far post. And then Memphis created a half chance for Frankie de Jong. If de Jong had gotten a boot to it, it might have been trouble. It might have gone in. But yeah, Atletico were really pretty comfortable ceding the possession of Barca. It was 68% in the first half. It was over 70 for the game, as I said. And Atletico knew that with Felix and Lemar at the outlets on the counterattack, that there would be space and there would be opportunity. And lo and behold, there were spaces and there was opportunity. What did you make of Joao in that first half? No goals or assists for him, but two pre-assists. I thought he was critical in the build-up. Is he continuing to get stronger? What did you think of his performance?
Yeah, like you said, actually, after the Milan game, I had said, oh, he needs that... confidence and everything. The ankle obviously was really bothering him last year, no?
Yeah.
He's giving himself a chance now, at least. Now that he's healthy, he has a chance now to at least take advantage of the minutes he's given, because last year, and throughout his career, he's been given half an hour here, an hour, and it's frustrating when you kind of know yourself, you're in one of those positions that when things aren't going well, you're going to be the first one taken off. Like, and that plays on your mind, and when you're a young player, and when you're not kind of, you don't have the, what they call it, in Spanish, and he doesn't have the weight of a Luis Suarez or something like that. So he's kind of, that's playing on your mind, with the fixed ankle, and what we saw in Milan when he came on, he was just calling for the ball. He wanted to be decisive. He felt important. He felt like, I can offer something here. And I think that was what we saw tonight in the first 45 minutes, was a continuation of that, where he even if you look at the first goal, where he kind of turns around,
yeah,
it's just like as if he was going to go off his right and turn, roll Araujo around his right, and he just kind of flicked it into his left and just kind of caught Araujo off guard.
Yeah.
And that just opened up the whole thing, and the fact that Barcelona kind of were vulnerable anyway at that point. I think Joao Felix was just kind of like, it's flowing for me here at the moment. I'm just going to keep going. And I think, and he felt important. He was given opportunities, and he took them.
Yeah, Araujo is Barcelona's best center back, I'd argue now. And he had some trouble tonight, particularly in the first half. That was just so smooth from Joao to help set up that first goal. And he was also fouled four times. Go ahead.
Sorry, no. And he was fouled. He's another player who I would describe as being very dynamic. He's able to kind of lose a man, just a kind of little shake of his hips, he's got like a little burst of speed that helps him lose defenders. And when your ankle isn't right, you lose, 50% of your game. So now that his ankle is right and he's feeling good, he can pierce defenses with those kind of darts and with his dynamism. So, and then also, when you're playing on the counter, especially drawing those fouls. And I mean, the referee was a little bit reluctant to pull out yellow cards, but there was a couple after maybe even just 15, 20 minutes when you were like, yeah, this is going to be a long night for Barcelona's defenders. And then, it was a tough one. And Araujo struggled, but I think any defender against an informed,
I agree. Gerard Pique just is so slow now, and he's not a great fit for a game like this, where you have Lemar, where you have Felix, where you have Correa, Griezmann available in reserve, when you have very tricky, skilled, technical attackers. The lack of foot speed in defense, and I mean, Araujo is the best Barca have right now, and Atleti didn't necessarily run rings around him in the first half, but again, they were electric on the counter, as they have been in recent meetings with Barca, as they've kind of weakened, well, more than kind of, they have weakened defensively, and they've lost somewhat of their identity. Atleti absolutely pounced on that in the first half, and the Suarez goal was just masterful, just a great example of clinical finishing. Of course, the image that's going around social media is holding up the thumb and the pinky to his ear, showing he didn't forget Ronald Koeman. He didn't forget what happened to him, forever using that as motivation.
Yeah, I think it was actually kind of funny that Koeman was on the phone at the time, obviously calling Henrik Larsson or whoever it was that he was talking to, And yeah, it was just kind of perfect timing as far as like, guys, let me. And then, but obviously, we all know that then. Suarez. He might forgive. He certainly doesn't forget, though. But it was also the fact that I think Suarez, I think like there's one thing about the way that Barcelona have gone in terms of the finances and decision making and thing. That's fine. It's the treatment of it and some of that could have been handled slightly differently. Like, this is a disaster, a crisis of to define all crises for football clubs. But at the same time, Barcelona really haven't helped themselves, and I know that like that kind of tends to happen when you are up against the wall and you're like, oh my God, what are we gonna do here? But at the same time, they probably could handle it slightly better, and I think that the way that they handled Suarez. Making him train with alone. Koeman called him, and then like just a 1 minute phone call basically ended his Barcelona career after everything he gave to the club. And as I said, given before about the Suarez's hierarchy or his status within the game and within the dressing room, I think that that really didn't go down well at all. And I think that's actually what's probably making all this 10 times worse for Barcelona at the moment.
Yeah, is that Koeman is just such an abrasive and stubborn character. It's certainly not helping these young players that Barca really have no choice but to bed through now because of their financial issues. I mean, the salary limits came out the other day. They're under 100 million. 100 million euros they can spend. Like, that's just shocking. That's astounding compared to where they were a couple of years ago. When it rains, it pours. They have fallen fast, and Atletico have kind of, it's coincided with Atletico maintaining and improving their play and improving their recruitment, and it shows up in games like this. And Suarez said midweek that the big games are for the big players, and it's these moments that you need to showcase your importance, your standing as a player. In the second half, it wasn't nearly that pretty from an attacking standpoint, but Atleti shut up shop defensively in that vintage Simeone fashion. I thought Jimenez was particularly spectacular in this game, Robbie. Completed 93% of his passes, won all his duels, 9 clearances, just fantastic. He led the way at the back.
Yeah, definitely, yeah, and it was And I don't really know. Obviously, you give Atletico credit because they shut out Barcelona, and that's always a positive. But like, Piqué came out and said we could be playing for 3 hours and we wouldn't score a goal.
Yep. So
I mean, I don't think that like for a team that, and all these players, I think, yeah, bar maybe Hermoso, but like, I mean, Savage and certainly Jimenez would have played under Simeone defense in that defensive kind of 4-4-2 and Cholismo, the original Cholismo, we'll call it. Mm-hmm. So like, they know how to play this, and we've seen years ago and even in the recent past, we've seen Atletico playing that style and being put under serious pressure. But this felt like a walk in the park for them, and the likes of Jimenez just loves that. I mean, bringing on not playing a pure nine, bringing on Ansu Fati, playing him centrally. I think this was a walk in the park for Atletico, and they would have liked to get another goal or two. The chances were there, but wasn't really convinced with Correa and that. But going the other way, like defensively, I thought this was just, like I said, a walk in the park for them.
Yeah, the guys who have been here a long time, you know, Jimenez has been here since 2013, Savage since 2015, Carrasco joined the team first time in 2015. Like, this was a throwback for these guys. Like, they were used to doing this, to the Cholismo 1.0, we'll call it. These guys are used to this. They know what is required when it's time to shut up shop. And I think Simeone handled it in terms of his substitutions. I think he handled it really, really well when it was time to kind of freshen things up. He tried by putting on Correa and Griezmann. Neither of them really did a whole lot. Those two looked rather disconnected, and that's something we obviously need to watch for as when we come back from international break. How will Griezmann look? How will his adaptation proceed in following his return from France duty? Because those two didn't really look like they'd been playing together a whole lot. But the story of the second half was the defense. I mean, Barcelona completed almost 650 passes. I'm watching the ESPN FC right now. They just showed a graphic. Almost 650 passes, and really very few of them were dangerous. I think Thomas Lemar did a great defensive job in the second half, tracking these runs from Sergio Roberto. Barcelona just really didn't have any solutions. I mean, the injuries haven't helped. No Pedri in this game really did hurt them. But they just didn't have any strategic or schematic solutions. As Pique said, this could have gone on for another couple hours and Barca probably still wouldn't have scored. It was eerily comfortable for Atleti.
And I guess the problem for Barcelona, this has been evident for the last number of years, but Messi always provided a solution. But I don't know, and I don't really know how you just come out and say, look, this is a complete rebuild, but or not even a complete rebuild. I don't know how you would do this, or at what point did Barcelona accept this, or how you do just accept it. But I think they have to just admit we have to start from scratch. And I also think that, and I understand that you can't just kind of throw out the philosophy for short-termism and that, but at the same time, like, when you're the problem with Barcelona at the moment is that they're living, and they have been living, fighting against nostalgia, and the problem with fighting against nostalgia is nostalgia always wins. There's nothing better than nostalgia. Like, you're looking back on, it wasn't like it used to be. Like, you know, there's even a saying that says, like, even nostalgia isn't what it used to be. Like, you know, I just think that there has to come a point where they just tear this whole thing down. And I'm not saying tear down the foundations of Cruyffism and all that, but accept that for the next year they are going to be really bad. And I know that, and this is a problem when you mix, like, or when you try to kind of keep up with PSG and Man City, and when you mix business and football, because business, capitalistic models, you just have to keep expanding, keep growing, keep increasing revenues.
Yeah.
But a football team can only, you can't just keep winning. Like, there has to be rebuilding years. There has to be down years. There has to be kind of processes of reinvention and re-establishing what you're good at. And, you know, like, there's not an endless amount of players. There's not an endless amount of world-class coaches. You get things wrong, like, with managerial appointments, and you have to kind of allow for that. And I think that Barcelona trying to keep up still with this kind of facade that we're still... Now I know that the players have come out and said, "Look, we are what we are." And I'm sure internally they're starting to address that. But at the same time, like, they're going to have to rethink their model of how they even play right now, because they're going to be humiliated if they keep on playing in the way that they do, given the standard of the player that they have available.
Yeah, it's at that club. It's just so difficult though, because of how business and football have been so closely intertwined, and not only that, but how intertwined the club is with the fans, because it's socio-run. Unlike, you know, very few clubs in Spain still have that status. It's been very difficult for them to accept. They've struggled in big games for years and just continued thinking short-term. But at that club, there seems to be it's a simultaneous refusal, but also an acceptance that, okay, we need to be looking 2-3 years in the future. Like, it's tough for them, but this has been a reckoning, what's gone on so far this season, and even some results last year. And the Koeman's record in big games just is not good. It's not pretty, other than, like, that Copa del Rey run last year, Barca have really been overmatched and outclassed in big games, the latest example being this one on Saturday. And when Father Time came calling for Godin and Felipe and Juan Fran a few years ago, Atleti moved on. Piqué and Busquets still have huge roles at Barca, and you could argue that they're past it, especially with how Koeman is trying or trying not to play. The salaries are still a huge issue, even though that wage bill has been slashed. It's really a divergence and a dichotomy between these two clubs and how they have been run in recent years. When Atletico came up with those issues, aging players, bloated salaries, they said, right, we're not going to tear this thing down to the studs, but we're going to rebuild intelligently. We're going to sell who we need to sell, and we're going to trust the coaching staff to put it all together, and they did. At Barca, it's a completely different story, in part because of the ownership model of the Cruyffistas, the Barca DNA. It's looking like a long road for them. It really is.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and I think that, like, sacking Koeman, and I think Koeman has his faults, but at the same time, he's fighting a lose-lose battle, like a losing battle. Like, he's got no chance. Like, I mean, because he's simultaneously being asked to rebuild with it, and also be competitive with a team that's just not competitive right now. And then you add the injuries in on top of everything, and the political turmoil surrounding everything, and the expectations that go with that. And Koeman really, like, I feel sorry for Koeman because he probably isn't up to the job, but he's also, and he also doesn't help himself with his hubris, but he's constantly fighting against this, and since the word go almost, maybe not the word go, he has been given plenty of time, but he's fighting against this, these two competing things where you have to be competitive and win, but you also have to do it with these academy players. And and without Messi and without Griezmann, like, we're just going to sell all the best players, and you have to do it with these guys now. And not even just the academy players, but Coutinho, who's just, he's almost seen as the epitome of the wasted, the profligate spending under Bartomeu. And he's going out on the field, and Coutinho, it's actually kind of sad how Coutinho's career has gone, because what age is he? He's like 30 now, is he?
Yeah.
No, he's 29. 29 now, like, and Jurgen Klopp said to him, he said, if you stay at Liverpool, they'll build a statue for you. And he wanted to go to Barcelona, he's gone to Barcelona, and the last 4 years have just been, depressing.
He's like a non-player now. And yeah, Coutinho is kind of the poster child for this now that he's still on the team. He's the one that Koeman is playing the most. And yeah, you're right. Koeman strikes, I wouldn't say Koeman is exactly a sympathetic character, but I mean, he's got a point, but up to a point. He's got a point that, you know, Barca have injuries and their squad has been slashed. So they can't play the way that the fans want them to play. But at the same time, yeah, he doesn't help himself with his press conferences and kind of deflecting blame and even attacking his players in the media. That's a no-go. That's a no-starter. Like, I can't imagine Cholo Simeone doing that, you know? I can't fathom Simeone taking those kinds of tactics. It's not really, doesn't strike me as healthy for team building or man management.
No, but I also don't think that Simeone would be put into that position where he felt like he was in a defensive position and he had to come out fighting, like, you know, and that's how, that's, Koeman's being treated like a cornered, kind of a cornered rat. I don't mean that in a bad way, but like he's a cornered animal, like, and he's going to come out and bite, like, so, and he's being treated a little bit like that, like he's being thrown into the corner, and he's like, no, hold on. Let me just get this straight here, because you're not going to have it all your own way, and we know it's all political, it's all, everything's done through the press and leaks, and that's another kind of a characteristic of the Barcelona collapse in recent years, is that, like, these leaks, and it's all, everything's done through the media, the press, social media, and it's just so messy, but yeah, I mean, we've kind of gone off the topic now. Where this is an Atletico Madrid podcast.
Haven't we?
it is worth mentioning because Barcelona have been one of Atletico's toughest rivals. Like every time you saw Barcelona, either at the Wanda or going to the Camp Nou, it was like, you'd absolutely take a draw with both hands, like, because they're always going to go, as you said at the start of the podcast, Messi, Dembele, always Suarez, even when he played for Barcelona, it was always something. And tonight it was like you're looking kind of waiting for that fight back, and you're like, it was 80 minutes, and you're like, I don't think it's coming there, it's not going to happen. And in one way, it's good to see Atletico winning so comfortably, but another way, it's kind of sad that Barcelona couldn't even muster a legitimate comeback.
Mm-hmm. How the times have changed indeed. And for the time being, Atletico are atop La Liga. Barca continue to fall. Now a 5-point gap this early in the season between Atletico and Barca. Real Madrid play Espanyol on Sunday. We'll see how that goes. But entering the international break, Robbie, the sensaciones, one of my favorite Spanish words, the vibes, the feelings, they're a lot better after these wins against Milan and Barcelona. Still a lot to work on, but wouldn't you say that the vibes are getting better now?
Yeah, definitely, and that's what we kind of said. I mean, it was definitely worrying, and it remains worrying. We'll see how they play against, I don't know who they have right after the international break, but we'll see how things pan out. But given the fact that, let's just say La Liga is a forgiving place this year, given the fact that there's no team to have it together, which is absolutely amazing for the competitive nature of the sport. Like, I mean, it's gone to the point where football is so predictable that, like, you fall behind by 6 or 9 points and say, yeah, that's it, by November or whatever. Whereas this year, it's kind of like anyone could pick up a bit of steam here at the right time. And not anyone, but, like, there's 4 or maybe 5 teams that could pick up steam at the right time and really make a go at this league. And I think, given the turmoil at Barcelona, obviously, and Real Madrid's kind of, like, we've seen them with weird wobbles against, they didn't look great against Villarreal and lost to Sheriff and, yeah, just some strange results. I think the quarterback in NFL, like, Atletico have Simeone, and he is, when you compare him to the other contenders, you would back Simeone out of all the other coaches to get to find a solution or to find a way to win. It mightn't be pretty, it mightn't be even overly consistent, but he's been there the longest, he's got the most trust out of all the managers, and he, like, in terms of from the ownership and that, his position is completely stable. You would be backing him if you had to pick, and you had to boil it down into, like, the most to the people on the sideline, you're picking Simeone. Yeah, 100 times out of 100, like.
Well, we've got a couple minutes left, Robbie. We both saw a certain film last night, obviously on different sides of the Atlantic, but let's have a brief movie corner here. A brief discussion on The Many Saints of Newark, the Sopranos prequel that dropped last night. I watched it at home on HBO. You went to the theater and saw it. What did you think?
You asked that with such people left, like, in the middle of it, like, it,
oh my,
and I just thought that I'd like to know why you thought it was good, because I'd like to, because I, like, I mean, I've got so many issues with it in terms of even the casting, like, Silvio Dante was like, what are you trying to do? Well, it was just so poorly cast. And Paulie Walnuts in the original series, The Sopranos, one of the best, funniest, most natural characters ever written in the history of a television series. And his character in this was, like, first he was poorly cast, as in, like, he didn't really kind of look too much like him, but he wasn't even funny. He had no depth. He was, like, kind of, like the time when the Johnny Soprano came out of prison, and they were like, "Oh, what's that guy doing living here?" And he said, "Oh, well, he's a doctor." And Paulie was like, "He's not operating on me." And I was like, "Is that all you've got for this guy?"
Is that the best joke you can write for him?
Yeah, like, come on, like, it was Paulie Walnut. Paulie Walnut's character was genius in the series, and this, oh man, I thought it was, yeah. But that's just one of the issues I have with it. Sorry.
Just one of the people were walking out, you said. Wow. Yeah, I had kind of an opposite view of it. Yeah, I thought some of the supporting characters weren't particularly well written, Paulie's especially. I will say, though, I'm not necessarily a big Sopranos fan. I'm not a big fan of the show. I'm planning to revisit it now because I really enjoyed the movie. But in the past, I've just kind of thought, eh, that's it. That being said, I did enjoy this film and thought the casting was a little bit better. I think having James Gandolfini's son play young Tony Soprano was great. I thought he was excellent in this movie. Alessandro Nivola as Dickie Moltisanti, great. I thought the film was centered on those two characters and their paths through this world, through the mob life in New York. It's obviously set in a very tumultuous time. I thought the casting was good. I thought it was well written. I thought it was well shot. I thought it was more than a competent film. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, but like the problem with so they got young Tony Soprano right, but it felt like, okay, we got him right, now we just fill all the edges in with whatever. And secondly, Tony Soprano, the Sopranos, the show, was built around the complexity of Tony Soprano's demons. Mm-hmm. And like, and they didn't go into any of it, they didn't add any layers to that. They didn't add anything to Tony Soprano. I thought we were going to get a look into what made him the way he is, or, you know, like, they focus it on Dickie Moltisanti, which is fair enough, but like, even that was kind of like, he was important enough in the show in that he kind of was like Christopher was very emotional when he talked about his dad, and kind of and Tony was really close to him and stuff like that, but like, I just feel like he took on a, like, why you? This is just about him. I was like waiting for to tell us about Tony, like, and how he became Tony Soprano. And I feel like they never added any depth to that. But my issue with like, when I walk out of a movie, like, and when I walked out of that movie, I felt like there was no character in that movie that I cared about. you know the way when you walk out of like. For example, like, I don't know, like, some of my favorite movies, like, say, Boyhood or something. I don't know if you've ever seen Boyhood.
Oh, yeah, but,
like, the guy in that, like, I mean, you felt like you cared about what happened to him, like, whereas with The Sopranos last night, I walked in and I was like, I don't care. I actually don't care. I don't care about any person that I saw in that movie. I don't care what happens to them. I'm not going home thinking about it. I'm not invested in these guys. I don't care. And it was just like a caricature of the show, like Junior Soprano, like, and I just felt really poor. I was so disappointed.
Interesting. Well, got some divergence of opinion here. That's healthy debate. Very healthy.
Yeah, exactly.
Your utter hatred of this film.
I think it's quite interesting that you said you were kind of meh about the series. So
yeah.
There's obviously something there, that, because I thought the series was just absolutely amazing. I think it just kind of depends on, and you could watch it again and be like, oh, wow, because when I first watched it, okay, I watched it and it was, oh yeah, that was great, yeah. But then I watched it a second time, I was just like, yeah. I think I read a lot about it and kind of what they were trying to do, and kind of tried to understand some of the characters a little bit more. And I was like, oh yeah, this is seriously deep. Like how they're trying to develop Tony and stuff like that. And yeah, so yeah. But I thought the series is amazing, and I just thought that the movie was just a little bit unnecessary. And then I read that David Chase kind of delegated out the directing to someone else.
Yeah, Alan Taylor.
He co-wrote it with someone else, and I was just like, that's what was wrong. David Chase's heart was never in it.
If it had been all David Chase, maybe it would have been better?
Yeah, maybe if it was like his... Like, if you ever saw the movie Deadwood, or saw the show Deadwood...
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing. And then David Milch was like, this deserves an ending that's fit for... The fans deserve an ending, and he poured his heart and soul into the movie. And the movie was absolutely amazing. Now, I understand that he had the characters to... where it was a sequel, so he could kind of... He could just bring the same people back and just kind of maybe add a couple of years to them, which almost happened naturally because given the space of time between, so it's a little bit easier in terms of casting. But he did the characters justice with what he was. He actually added layers to like Al Swearengin and like gives them a proper sequel. And I understand that the Many Saints of Newark is a prequel, but he added layers to, you go back and watch the show and it actually helped then to kind of knit things together properly, and you know, but I felt like the Many Saints of Newark didn't do that at all.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. That was our movie corner for this week's show. We might revisit it. We might do this again if we encounter a film that we're both dying to see but have divergent opinions on. This was good. I like this. Make it a semi-regular feature. Robbie Dunn, thank you so much for coming on this edition of Culture Narrow Chat.
Absolutely no problem, Jeremy. I'll chat to you soon.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you all for listening. We'll have some content over the international break as several Culture Narrows are going to be playing for their national teams. So keep it here. Keep it on into the calderon.com, patreon.com/Culture Narrow Chat as well. We'll talk to you all again soon. Adios.